the regular business meeting of the Bainbridge Island City Council for Tuesday, February 24th. And we have a full quorum. Everybody's in attendance. Council members Roth, Blossom, Scott, Tollefson, Bonkowski, Townsend, and I'm Ann Blair. I would like to invite you all please to stand and repeat the Pledge of Allegiance with us.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. In consideration of tonight's agenda, are there any points of modification changes? Then I would entertain a motion, please, with regard to accepting it as presented.
I move we accept the motion as presented.
Second.
All right. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Abstaining? Thank you. The agenda is approved. And we'll open the meeting now for public comment. And as a regular business meeting, we've said this before, this is an opportunity for the community to comment on any aspect of city business. We aren't going to be taking public comment within the rest of the context of the meeting. So if you have something to say, please come to the podium and introduce yourself and identify the area or your address.
There will be comment.
Yes, you're right. You know what? I'm interrupting. We're having a slight conversation. No, you're fine. But I will just tell you all that I was corrected that when we get to the work session portion of the agenda, we will, in fact, have public comment as a part of that work session. So I'm sorry to interrupt you, but please go ahead.
Good evening. I'm Krista Little. I reside at 16222 Rytan Road in Bainbridge. And I'm here this evening to address item F, which is the Comcast franchise negotiations. Years ago, I was involved in the studies and discussions that led to the City of Seattle's establishment of their telecommunications office, and also spent several years involved in the telecommunications industry. So I have some knowledge of what can legitimately be expected, and I applaud the city manager and the council for getting the assistance and the consultant. It's a very complex area and one that really the city wants to maximize its revenues and its the performance of the vendor. And so I think this is an excellent step. I do have two suggestions, and they may well be included in the contract under customer service issues. But because of my own current experience with Comcast, I'm particularly sensitive to two things that I would recommend be addressed directly by the consultant and in the contract. And those are, one, customer service performance standards and hopefully some type of penalty procedure that addresses poor performance. And it really is critical that the city step in this case because there is no one else. The FCC doesn't deal with customer service issues. The state doesn't. It's really the community that owns the right-of-ways and the properties that this vendor uses. So that would be one suggestion, and as I said, it may already be included. The other is the issue of rate and offering equity. And I'm bringing this up because it has been an issue on the island in the past. And we want to make sure that whatever the citizens of Bainbridge get in their contract is equitable with other communities in the area. So again, that may fall within the framework of the existing proposal, but I did want to underline the need for that. And the reason I'm here today is that this morning Comcast sent out the fifth installation team. It's been 2 months since I've had telephone, television, or internet through Comcast. Almost 2 months. I cannot tell you, I can just tell you I have well over a work week in on calls on this. What I have discovered is that When you call, once you're bounced around the world, you may be fortunate enough to end up with someone in the United States who can understand what you're describing. Then you will be given to the loyalty program because they want to ensure that you don't leave as a customer. You will talk to a loyalty supervisor. However, after weeks, you will discover that loyalty supervisors are not allowed to directly contact the technical services section. So if you have a technical problem, they have no way of immediately dealing with the issue. You will deal with technical services worldwide and then hopefully in the U.S. and finally get to a supervisor. During this time, they will undoubtedly disconnect you numerous times. And
I do have to ask that you go ahead and wrap it up. As much as we all sympathize.
I was just going to say that five times they have sent out a team for work that they're not prepared to do. And it really is unacceptable. But there's nothing that citizens can do. Absolutely nothing. So it would be nice to see some type of performance measurement in the contract. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak? Seeing no one, we'll go on with the rest of the agenda. And next on the agenda is the city manager's report, and I'll look to Doug Schultz.
Okay. So last week was a short week due to the President's Day holiday on Monday. I did have a couple items, though, to report on from last week. We had a meeting with representatives from CENTCOM to talk about the tower project that they've been working on to improve the emergency radio service for the island first responders. And we'll be bringing forward a discussion about that with the council in the future. Second item, on May 5th, we are going to be participating with the Navy's emergency management exercise. This is an exercise regarding a radiological event and the response to that. However, our participation will be limited to a tabletop exercise rather than a full-blown participation with what the county will be doing. The other item I have is our new telephone system is supposed to go live tomorrow. So there may be periods of time where the City Hall phones are not working properly, and it may be difficult to get through. But they've been running through that all day today and feel like they've got everything worked out so that it should go relatively smoothly. The last items I have are the listening sessions. We've got one more this week. That's tomorrow evening here at City Hall at 6:30. And the topic is the green, well-planned community and vibrant economy. And then the final two listening sessions are Monday, March 2nd at 10 a.m. and Wednesday, March 4th, 6:30 p.m., also here at City Hall. And both of those sessions will be on reliable infrastructure and a healthy and attractive community. Any questions?
Thank you. All right, next on the agenda is a presentation from the Kitsap Public Health District. And I would like Councilmember Blossom to do the introductions. She's our liaison to the Public Health District.
Stuart Whitford and Eva Krim from the Kitsap Health District are going to present the results of an EPA-funded shoreline survey.
Thank you and good evening. It's a pleasure to be here tonight, and also very appreciative of your interest in our EPA Shellfish Restoration and Protection Project, which just got wrapped up a couple of months ago at the end of December. I'd like to introduce Stuart Whitford, who's here with me this evening as well, and he'll be giving a portion of this presentation. And I'd also like to introduce a coworker of mine, Susan Walther, who's also here and was just back from doing some shoreline sampling on Crystal Springs and Agate Pass. So the work is continuing. But anyway, we did finish this project, and we were fortunate to receive a grant from EPA back in 2010 for $997,000 to conduct the Shellfish Restoration and Protection Project. The project started around mid-2014, and it ended at the end of 2010 is when it began, ended in 2014. And the purpose, as you can see here, was to restore and protect shellfish growing areas throughout Kitsap County. The way we approached this is we wanted to set up a comprehensive shoreline monitoring program. In our program, in our Water Pollution Identification and Correction Program, we've done shoreline monitoring over the years in targeted areas as they related to smaller grants, but we wanted to try to do a much larger comprehensive one that covered about 80 miles in this particular project. The point was to, as we do these shoreline surveys, what we do is we walk along the beach, we collect water samples, we test them for fecal bacteria, and if they are above a threshold, we classify those as hot spots, and then we conduct our investigative work to see if we can't find the source of that water pollution, correct it, and then protect water quality and certainly the shellfish growing area. Part of this project also included numerous education and outreach activities. A little difficult to see, but this is a map that is from the Washington State Department of Health website that shows they're the folks that classify shellfish growing areas. And you can see in green are those approved areas, which we were setting out to protect with this project, and then the red areas are prohibited. Now, we didn't do every single spot on the map. We did a portion along the Hood Canal from Bangor, including the subbase south, all the way down to the county line. At the north end, we went from Kingston north to Point No Point. We did a portion along Indianola. We did all of Miller Bay, as you can see, as red is prohibited. And so that was where our efforts were. We were trying to look at that prohibited area and hopefully get that cleaned up so it could be upgraded. We did part of Suquamish, and then we did all of Bainbridge with the exception of Eagle Harbor. And the other two areas in red that you see on the island, certainly, as you recognize, are Agate Pass to the north and Crystal Springs. And we put a lot of effort there as well because, again, we're hoping to have upgrades. And then further south in the county, we did the area south of Manchester. That green section there just west of Blake Island is called Yukon Harbor. So we walked that shoreline, and then we continued south all the way to the county line. So it was a pretty fairly energetic effort. A fun project. And then you can see here a little bit more of a close-up of where we went around the island. Again, all the areas in green, and with the exception, like I said, we did not go around into Eagle Harbor. What we hope to achieve in this project are listed here. These were very measurable outcomes, and what we had hoped to realize was an increase in harvestable shellfish growing areas. We had hoped to obtain sustainable funding to keep this work going. We have done this, like I said, in the past in smaller areas. This was a larger project, but we find that it's a very effective way to find sources, clean them up, and protect our waters. We also hope to achieve measurable improvements in water quality in at least 50% of the streams and the marine waters that were associated with this project. We wanted to increase education and awareness and also achieve a sustained participation in the local community shellfish farm. Obviously, a lot of tasks associated with this big project, but overall, we did complete 4 shoreline surveys covering about 320 miles. The reason we did 4 of them is we do 2 during wet weather conditions and 2 during dry weather conditions. In total, what we found were 126 hotspots or confirmed drainages that had elevated levels of bacteria above our threshold. We completed 558 property inspections as a result of that investigative work, identified 56 on-site septic system failures. And our PIC program has been around since 1996, and when we do this kind of work, we have found, on average, anywhere between a 7 to 10% failure rate when we're finding septic as sources of this pollution. And so this was a little bit more targeted, and hence I think our rate was higher. On Bainbridge Island, we found 49 shoreline hotspots that were confirmed. We did roughly 3 shoreline surveys covering about 66 total miles, inspected 107 properties, and found 21 on-site septic system failures. The failure rate was much higher, as you can see, compared to the overall project. And I think because we had not done such a comprehensive shoreline program on the island before, could be one of the reasons why we found so many sources. And I'm pleased to say that we met a lot of our measurable outcomes. And so here, the next slide shows that we did working with DOH, achieve an upgrade in some shellfish growing area down south along Colvo's Passage of 30 acres. We are also hopeful that they are also looking at Miller Bay, and there's a possibility that Miller Bay will go from prohibited to approved probably in the next couple of years, because they're currently monitoring and this project actually raised their level of awareness, and they have confidence in us in the work that we did. We're going to be able to share the information that we obtained to help them assess Miller Bay and upgrade it. That would be about 270 acres upgrading, going from prohibited to approved. We also were successful in receiving sustainable funding. Kitsap County Stormwater Division will support an ongoing routine shoreline monitoring program, and in fact, that monitoring program began last year. We also were successful in seeing improvements. About 58% of our streams and our marine waters in the project area as a result of this work. We saw improvements in land practices. Obviously, 55 failing septic systems were identified. Actually, 56. We found another one. And then 100% of them have either been repaired or in the process of being repaired. To measure education and awareness, following our property inspections, we did a mail-in survey. We were hoping for about a 30% response rate, and I think we got 45%, so that was good. And then our community shellfish farm, we couldn't have done this without the good work of Betsy Peabody and the Puget Sound Restoration Fund. Their target was to engage 50 families in the shellfish farm over on Port Madison, and they exceeded their goal. They actually started at 13 families, and they raised it up to 59. So, again, raising the level of awareness of the importance of water quality and shellfish protection, this was a wonderful partnership. The other thing I want to point out is that when we did a lot of our shoreline work, when we go back, we collect 3 samples. So we do these confirmation samples, and we did have the great help of Cammie and her crew here on the island going out and helping us do some of that legwork for those confirmation samples. So I want to recognize and thank Cammie for helping us at the onset of this project. Okay, so I got those two folks covered. I also want to acknowledge, obviously, the Clean Water Kitsap, which is the program used to be called the Kitsap County Surface and Stormwater Management Program. It's the Kitsap County Stormwater Division, but the program is called Clean Water Kitsap. They just changed their name last year, which I'm sure you're aware of. I want to acknowledge their support. The total cost of this project, as I mentioned, of the award was $997,000. EPA gave us $668,000. Clean Water Kitsap matched those dollars for us to complete this project, and then, of course, EPA. Now, the other thing that we wanted to focus on, and I'm going to turn it over to Stuart, is the work that we've done over in Agate Pass and Crystal Springs. Want any of this, or what do you want? Okay.
So, thanks for taking let us have some time tonight to talk to you guys. And, you know, it's a really exciting project, what happened with the staff out here on the island. And you can see the tremendous results that they found. It's also just a little bit concerning. You know, we mentioned how many hotspots we found here on the island and how many failures we found. And it's primarily because there hasn't been maintenance done as far as shoreline maintenance, sampling the shoreline, you know, looking for elevated bacterial counts and tracing back to source. And these type of shoreline failures are typically unknown to property owners. They don't know they're occurring. That's the key point you guys need to remember, is they don't know, because they're going out through pipes that are oftentimes hidden, they're going to bulkhead drains, they're So to them, in their yard, everything's fine. But actually down on the beach, where a lot of them recreate and collect shellfish and swim during the summer, it's not good. And so two things I want to talk about tonight. The first is Agate Pass and Crystal Springs are an area of focus for us right now. Those areas were downgraded by the State Department of Health portions thereof in 2009. And this is a big deal. When the state does this, it causes the health district to react, and it causes, in this case, the city of Bamers to react. And we've been working very hard since 2009 to get these areas upgraded. And I want to report tonight that we're getting closer, but we still have a number of problems that we're trying to address. The main problem that we have going forward is after this year, we won't have any dedicated resources to conduct these investigations. Right now, we're using general health district revenue to continue on a probably a daily basis for the rest of the year. Sue Walther will lead that effort with my supervision. But that's all that we can afford to do at this point, because she's also trying to finish up a major project in Murden Cove, Murden Creek. And also, in addition to the downgrade on Crystal Springs and Agate Pass, we had a threatened status issuance by Department of Health for a saltwater station at the mouth of Fletcher Bay. And so we have begun investigations, very detailed investigations there as well. What we're trying to do is get these areas restored and protect areas from getting downgraded. Because obviously shellfish are, not everyone eats shellfish, but it's a great indicator of good water quality. Good water quality is good for the economy here throughout Kitsap County. It's good for recreation and it's good for public health. Just being able to touch the water and not get sick is really important, you know, to the health district. So that's what we're trying to do. So in terms of Agate Pass and Crystal Springs, like I said, we're getting closer, but it's a very complicated investigation. We're conducting multiple dye traces of septic systems right now in those areas. We're dye tracing homes that are in some cases a couple hundred yards away from the shoreline that we've proven are leaking onto the shoreline. So you can see that this is a lot of scientific effort that goes into this. And then obviously when we find problems, it causes concern with property owners because they know how expensive it is to replace septic systems. And believe me, we don't get that excited when we find these things, because we know that the burden that's going to put on property owners. So in a larger policy discussion, you guys are familiar with Puget Sound Partnership, the Puget Sound Action Plan, and the West Central Local Integrating Organization, which Cami and Melva participate on. And one of the near-term actions that has been elicited is for there to be a funding resource for ongoing shoreline monitoring on Bainbridge Island. We now have achieved such funding for unincorporated Kitsap. We don't have funding for Bainbridge Island. Going forward, I estimate somewhere around 50 miles or so of shoreline. I would recommend a program that does all of the island, not exclude Eagle Harbor, but include it, about 53 miles. And from the EPA project, we know that the cost per mile is around $3,000. So we think in 4 years, you could cover the whole island, and it would be about $40,000 per year to conduct such a program. So I'd just like to put that bug in your guys' ear to start thinking about that down the line, probably beginning for 2016. I think that would be an excellent way for the city to help us with that. Our preference is not to get state grants, because of how much maintenance and management is required with those. And we think that a dedicated local funding source, would be better. And we do recognize, of course, that the city does participate annually to the health district. However, those dollars are always earmarked for other more crucial public health needs. So that's the main message I wanted you guys to think about tonight. And I wanted to thank your staff here. We are part of a big team that's trying to do this. We think it's really important for public health and the economy, and we'll hope you'll support it. You have any questions?
Could you go over the numbers again? I thought you said there was like 53 miles, and it was like $3,000 a mile.
Yeah, so I was figuring if you go 13 miles per year over 4 years, then it works out to be about $40,000 per year.
Per year. Per okay. Year. Thank you.
$40,000 per year to get the work done.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Okay, thank you. We are later going to be... Oh, I beg your pardon. I overlooked someone. Val Tollefson?
Could you just give us 30 seconds on what the monitoring consists of physically? What's somebody doing when they're out there?
Yeah, well, actually, Sue was just out there late this afternoon into the evening.
What were you doing, Sue?
Sue, actually, why don't you come up and say what you were doing today, okay? So you could they could hear a real-world example.
So, good evening. Susan Walther with Kitsap Public Health, and I went out today to Agate Pass and Crystal Springs looking at the 12 hot spots that we're still working on. And what I did is some sampling where I took samples 5 minutes apart, three different samples per location, and I did E. coli sampling. So I've turned them into the lab this evening, and then we'll have results from there, and we'll go forward to try to figure out, are these areas still elevated? Are they dry weather condition elevated? Do we need to sample again in wet weather? And then look at the homes that are in the area and do surveys to try and figure out, are there failing septic systems for these hot spots?
Do you want to describe the way you do the survey and identify how a hot spot is found? With the dye?
So when we're doing shoreline surveys, we're looking for any freshwater flows that are coming from on land that end up in our salt waters, and we sample those. We record them by marking the GPS locations, and we take photo logs and descriptions of the type of pipe, if it's a 4-inch corrugated pipe, or if it's a metal pipe, if it's a seep through a bulkhead. We make those notations, and we take photos. And then when it comes up elevated, we go back out two more times to confirm that it wasn't just a fluke, that it really is an elevated level. And once we've confirmed that it is hot spot, then we go upland to try and figure out where is that coming from. Is it from a failing septic system? Is it from wildlife? Is it from pet waste? So we look at all those things. And when we survey homes, we're asking the homeowners, and we're talking about giving them information on their on-site septic systems, looking at their permits, giving them tips about extending the life of their septic system. So it's also an educational component. And we walk their drain field with them, talk to them about what the signs of failing septic systems are. And so we proceed through an area that roughly is within 200 feet from that shoreline hotspot to try and figure out what might be happening.
Thanks. Any other questions about the process or the report? Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is timely for sure because, as we've talked about, our work session later this evening will be focusing on shoreline monitoring. So this is nice background to have to include in that conversation. Thank you. So the next thing on our agenda is the consent agenda. And I would talk to the board and entertain a motion to deal with that. Thank you. Yeah, no, it doesn't get to. I just have to wait a minute, and Steve has raised his hand.
I move we approve the consent agenda items A through F.
Second.
Thank you. All those in favor of the consent agenda as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Abstaining? All right, thank you. It's approved as presented for us. And next, we really are now going to move into our work session. And, no, we're not. I'm jumping, and I'm glad because the timing was just, I was trying to keep track of that. This is the conversation about the Housing Resources Bainbridge request for the Housing Trust Fund grant. And this is basically a conversation within the City Council. We talked about it last week and agreed that it would be a more fulsome conversation if everybody on the Council was in attendance, and we are. So I'll look to Council Member Tollefson, because this has been something that you initiated initially in the budget conversations, and appreciate your help.
Thank you very much. And I was one of your Rapt watchers by TV last week, and I appreciate the Council kicking this forward, and I paid attention to your discussion. First of all, on our agenda bill, I think that there's an error. It indicates that we've allocated $150,000 to the Housing Trust Fund this year, and I think actually what we did was allocate $100,000 this year and $100,000 next year. Mm-hmm. So we're starting from 100 available, I think, for this year. The request for $150,000 from HRB obviously is beyond what we could do, even if we wanted to give them everything we had this year. But As I indicated in a memo I wrote for you last week, it's my understanding that HRB can meet its needs if it had half of that money each year. I understand Mayor Blair suggested that $100,000, $50,000 a year would be something she would support, and I simply want to say that I understand the interest in having a little money kept in your pocket, but this is a real project that's underway that has a real need, and we have made a real commitment in our comprehensive plan toward affordable housing. I think this, in the context of the entire budget for this project, this is a modest request, and I think that it, I personally think that it's our obligation, absent some other concrete project in the works, to do what we can do to support it. And so at the appropriate time, I would like to move that we authorize transfer of $75,000 in each of the this year and the next year to HRB for this project.
Thank you. Okay.
I'll second that. That was a motion.
I don't think it was. Well,
I think we're not looking for action, actually.
Tonight is a discussion with the idea of outlining something that would go forward to staff that could come back to us in a formal motion and prepare for that. So, Steve, it sounds like you'd like to speak to this.
I would. What I heard last week from the Housing Resource Board was the driver for getting the allocation from the city of Bainbridge Island was to have enough money, if you will, in hand to secure the financing to get the project started this year. And if that is indeed the case, I can certainly support the $150,000, $75,000 this year and $75,000 next year, with a proviso that the project gets started this year. Because if it's not, it basically gives the, from what I understand, a number of the other grants would then fall off this year, and we would now be in a position of trying to figure out, or HRB would be in a position of trying to figure out how to put the project together again. And so, if we're going to make that kind of a commitment, I think it has to be gated by having the project start and getting the rest of the financing done this year.
Thank you. Any other comments? Sarah?
Can you remind me what you had proposed last week?
I did. Yes, and I would be glad to speak to that. I propose that we go forward and support this project, which I do, but with a different funding amount. And I would propose that we provide $100,000 total, $50,000 this year and $50,000 next year. And my thinking about that is that we are early into this year, and we have an ongoing conversation about a number of different options and ideas. We haven't decided on other ways to support affordable housing and workforce housing needs on the island. We've talked about doing something with the Suzuki property to research that. It may cost some money down the line. I have no idea. We haven't developed that. It's just early in the year to commit all but $50,000. And I appreciate the fact that this is a concrete and a real project, and I would very much like to be a part, have the city be an affirmative part of it in a significant way. But as we looked at the budget last week, there was $100,000 that was going to be sought from other funding sources, private funding sources in the community, and I propose that I would prefer that the larger amount of money, $150,000, be something that's supported by a broader array of funding sources. I still think that.
And I supported that last week, and mm-hmm. I still support that.
Anyone else wanting to talk about it? Mike, it looks like you're...
I would just say that I had the opportunity to meet last week with representatives of Housing Resources Bainbridge, and it did strike me as a very worthwhile project. Mm-hmm. I can't claim to be as intimately familiar as perhaps other members of the council are with the overall budget and funding sources, but as it stands now, I'd be inclined to support the request just because I don't see any other concrete proposals coming down the road this year, and we're already at the end of February. But I'm sympathetic to the need to save money for other projects as well, so I feel a little bit...
They're an unknown. Okay, thank you. Other comments? Thinking? Yeah, Wayne?
You want to follow up?
Well, to name one, the council has said that the Suzuki subcommittee could look at hiring a development consultant for that property, and that's going to cost money. And another one, I believe that, and I may be wrong, but Helpline House administers the emergency rental assistance.
Mm-hmm.
And
Go ahead.
I don't know if they're going to have needs as well. I can tell you, as someone who receives rent checks from people, I have seen more assistance from Helpline this year than I have in the past 3 years.
Good, thank you. Wait.
Mine was related to that. It'd be good just to refresh what our commitment's been to the development consultant for Suzuki.
At this point, there's been no commitment because we haven't come to the council even with a proposal for what that might look like. What we had agreed to do was to research the way we would even put that, an RF. Queue out, period, if we would do that, and we have not made that determination. So we're working on it, but it hasn't come back to the council. We have no sense of whether the council collectively will even approve
right,
it.
Right, no, I understand that, but okay. I thought we determined that we would get from staff some kind of proposal or scope of what a development consultant would do. I thought that was our next
That is the next thing you can expect from the Suzuki people,
right.
But we have not had that.
Okay.
We haven't gotten any traction on that. We will next week.
Good. Thank you.
Good. Thank you for asking. Thanks, Phil. Any other? Yeah, Roger?
Do we know a ballpark for that, or is that...
No, we don't know any ballpark. We don't know anything about timing. Council hasn't made any decision about what's going to happen with Suzuki. So, I'm very sympathetic to Ann's view of this, Mayor Blair's view of this, it's saving money for a rainy day that we don't know is going to happen against putting up an umbrella for the current storm, I guess. I think we ought to have some sort of a straw vote or something so that we know what to ask.
I think that's a good idea. We do need to hear from everybody first.
Right. That's fine.
And at this point, I think we have. Does anyone wish to make any other comments? I mean, I think we've been pretty, well, at least we've indicated we may have made up our own individual minds. And I think a straw ballot or a straw vote is a good idea. And I would like to also then, depending on how that goes, I think there's support for the project, but I do think we need to be explicit about wanting that to then come back to us for formal action in the form of an agenda bill. It appears to me that the real debate at this point is not the support of this project. There's unanimous support from everyone that's spoken quite supportively about it. However, it is about the amount of money to be committed this year and next. So I would ask for a show of hands for those who would support the $75,000 to go this year and $75,000 to be committed for the following year. And Steve's suggestion was that there be also a caveat saying pending the fact that the full financing is available and the project is able to begin this year. And seeing the nod of heads, it seems to me that caveat is a part of the $75,000. I would recommend it be a part of the $50,000 also. So everybody that's in favor of going with the $75,000, and we'll go in that direction. Four of you, and I would think that then the three of us are supportive of the other, so we'll ask the staff to look at the $75,000. Sure.
One of the reasons that I'm supportive of the $150,000, because if you look at the finance stuff that's laid out here, the key commitment is the $150,000. One of the things that you could consider, if there are concerns about additional projects this year. You could consider 50 this year and 100 for next year. Now it says, well, wait a minute, that says that you're going to spend all the money for next year. But in reality, we go through, even though it's a biannual budget, we go through a re-wickering of the next year's budget. And so if we made a commitment for 50 this year to hold 50 back now for the unknowns for this year, we could then certainly go and look at recommitting and changing the number for next year.
I'd like to suggest a different spin on that, if that's something you want to do, and that is that if you wanted to do that, that we ought to give them 100 this year and 50 next year. And if something that we don't currently know about comes up this year, we can borrow from one of the other funds for a couple months fund what we need to, and we'll get it out of next year's money. So.
At this point, I think there's support for going with the $75,000, unless there's some additional and specific support for changing that initial draft. We'll look at it. We'll ask the staff to draft an agenda bill in that direction. And we can reconsider once we see it in type, we decide, whoops, we do want to change it. We'll be in a position to do that with a formal vote, and that would come up at next week's meeting. Okay? Thank you. Anything else on that topic? All right. Thanks. All right. Now we can go on to the work session. And the work session is exactly that. We'll have a presentation from our associate planner, Christy Carr, who's working on the shoreline management, this being her special bailiwick, not only with the background she brings to it, but with the assignment she's accepted. And after she's made her presentation, the council will go ahead and ask questions for clarifying, that sort of thing. And then we'll take comments from the community, and we'll go back to the council. Hopefully there'll be some give and take. And Christy and Kathy Cook will ask you all to be handy after your presentation so you can help us work through any questions and comments that come up.
Hello. Thanks for having us here tonight. As Mayor Blair said, I'm here to present three alternatives, actually, for shoreline master program monitoring. And just as a reminder, at the January 6th council meeting, you did direct us staff to develop a range of options based on the Department of Ecology requirements, as well as council and community preference for a more robust monitoring program than that is required. I want to say at the outset that, as noted in your council packet and the memo that was included, that staff is recommending alternative 2 out of 3, recognizing that it could ultimately be a hybrid of all three alternatives and that it will take more work to finalize. I'm in charge here. So I'm going to start with a bit of background on monitoring the SMP that I'm hoping will provide more context as our discussion moves forward and in your consideration of the three alternatives. Then I will provide a brief comparison of each alternative, highlighting similarities as well as pointing out some major differences, followed by a more detailed description of each alternative. We can follow that with questions and or discussion period and finish with council direction on next steps. I know that all of you are familiar with the city's recent SMP update process, but I want to just spend a few minutes on what we are monitoring to try to get us on the same page as we move forward with this discussion tonight. Let me catch up here. So the Shoreline Master Program guidelines are state standards that all jurisdictions have to follow when they're updating their master programs. And the SMP guidelines is where we got this wonderful notion of no net loss of shoreline ecological functions. So simply stated, while it's vague and not clearly defined in the SMP or the guidelines, means that the existing conditions of shoreline ecological functions should remain the same throughout SMP implementation. As you also are familiar with, the city needs to periodically update or review its SMP and make amendments deemed necessary to reflect changing local circumstances, new information, or improved data. And at the next periodic review, the city must demonstrate that the SMP is achieving no net loss. So given that, monitoring results from a monitoring program should then inform the periodic review and provide quantitative information for any potential policy and or regulatory change. So I tried to present this in sort of a graphic format for people who might be a little bit more visual. So monitoring efforts overall should serve two primary goals: an evaluation of existing conditions and an assessment following implementation of management actions. So in this case, our existing conditions are all the SMP planning documents that were completed as part of the update process, the land use land cover map that I'll go into a little bit more detail on later, but that's the LIDAR and high resolution imagery map that's going to be created as part of our nearshore grant program work, and then other data sources that may be gathered or have been gathered from other agencies or efforts. The management action in this case is the implementation of the SMP. So that's permit review with required mitigation attached to permit approval, as well as restoration plan actions. Because if you remember, the SMP includes not only permit review, but it also has a restoration plan. So then we get to our periodic review, and I anticipate what that would include is SMP planning documents will be updated along with the land use land cover map, and then a roll-up of all the monitoring data that we're going to gather from all that permit review with required mitigation, and as well as taking a look at those other data sources to see if they've been updated or modified in any way. So at that point, we should have sufficient information to conduct an assessment where have management actions, that being SMP implementation, affected existing conditions, and if so, what should change? I'm actually going to skip this one because it's a bit repetitive. And we've also talked about that the Department of Ecology, while they require this no net loss provision, they don't have a lot of formal requirements for it. But when we have talked with the Department of Ecology and our shoreline planner there, this is the guidance that we've gotten from them for demonstrating no net loss. The focus should be on tracking all permits and restoration projects in the shoreline, tracking only development within the SMP jurisdiction, because what we're monitoring are activities requiring shoreline review or permits. It doesn't require producing new data. It could be done just once as part of this periodic review, yet an annual report would be useful and offers a good chance of taking a look at whether the SMP is working. So we developed a range of alternatives, three alternatives on kind of your basic high, medium, and low spectrum in terms of the resources that would be required to implement and manage. And each of the alternatives that were developed kind of are within a framework of a basic approach, the parameters for monitoring and establishing the baseline, staffing, funding, the involvement of volunteers and community participation, coordination with other programs, and oversight. So just really briefly, what all three alternatives have in common, they all meet the minimum ecology requirements. They all will include the completion of the new land use land cover map as part of our nearshore grant program work. And included in that, which I think sometimes gets lost, is that there will be up to 50 data plots established as part of that work, generally or to ground truth the map. But we will have those data plots established as part of that grant funded project. All of the alternatives will track the permits and permitted actions in terms of basic information such as the type, the number, and the location. And then all of the alternatives assume that the periodic review will be completed in 7 years and include the background document and studies and land use land cover update as needed. So some major differences of the three alternatives: there's no new data collection in alternative one. There's limited data collection in alternative two, again using those data plots that are established with the land use land cover map. Additional staff is required only in alternative three. New funding for each of the alternatives varies from none in alternative one to between $72,000 and $137,000 for alternative three. That's on an annual basis. And it could vary from year to year. It may not be a straight line projection. There's no use of volunteers or community participation in alternative one, and there's no coordination with other programs or efforts in alternative one. So the alternatives, 1, 2, and 3. Start with 1, and the basic approach is meeting ecology's requirements, which is demonstrating that we meet no net loss. And ultimately, in approving the SMP update, ecology concluded formally that if carefully and thoroughly implemented, the SMP will, on its own, achieve no net loss. So that is the basic approach of alternative 1, is demonstrating that we are thoroughly and carefully implementing our SMP. It does include the land use land cover map. Again, no new data will be collected, and the permits will be tracked through our existing permit tracking system. And I'm happy to answer questions if you guys aren't aware of the permit tracking database software that the planning and building divisions use. We can talk a little bit more about that. It'll use existing planning staff, and no new funding is anticipated to be needed. If the periodic update would likely be in all three alternatives, something that would require additional funding, although the Department of Ecology in the past has provided grants to jurisdictions for that update process. So that's a possibility. And again, no volunteers, no coordination, and it would just be an annual reporting of the permit tracking activities to both the ETEC and to council. Alternative 2 is a more robust permit tracking system, as well as some limited data collection using those data points that have already been established as part of the land use land cover map. And the data would likely be on parameters that can easily be captured, such as impervious surface area, shoreline armoring, and potentially water quality. And then this alternative would also include developing a shoreline-specific permit tracking system, and this kind of gets into the weeds a little bit, but I think that it's really important because it's something that planning staff can do now, although as if you look at the staffing need, it would mean that current planning staff would need to be reallocated or specifically dedicated to this monitoring effort because it kind of goes above and beyond what we really need to do to track permits. It starts to gather more metrics and information on the permit review level, which is kind of exciting, I think, that we could do that. We can capture a lot of information. Staff's been working pretty hard on this effort and revising our application so that we can capture it at that time, and then we can use it in the monitoring efforts. So we would also rely on coordination with other work being done by other agencies and explore grant opportunities for primary data collection. One example of other work being done right now, I'm participating in an advisory group with Kitsap County. They have a grant for a nearshore prioritization project, and it's pretty neat, I think, that Bainbridge Island has been included in this. It's a West Sound sort of regional effort, and all of Bainbridge Island is being included, and so that means that some of our shoreline projects, something that might be in our restoration plan, could rise to the top on a prioritized list of projects for the whole West Sound region. So those sorts of coordination efforts, I think, can be really key because we are an island, but we're an island in the middle of the Sound. So I look forward to working with other jurisdictions and local groups and regional, state, tribal groups on that effort. So again, I'm not anticipating any new funding for this effort, although we would be potentially looking at working with our Public Works Department. They have an ongoing water quality monitoring program. They have an existing volunteer recruitment program as well as an intern availability, and if water quality is one of the parameters that we do decide to collect water, we collect data on, then it makes sense to work with our Public Works Department in the framework of their program. So I'm also exploring grant funding opportunities, such as the NEP grant that I'll be talking with you about next week. We would try to incorporate the use of volunteers for data collection and also work to engage the broader community in monitoring efforts, and that could be as simple as making it fun and easy for permit recipients to do their own monitoring when they do have mitigation required as part of a permit review process. It could be that they could have some fun taking photos and running transects or citizen science. So again, more extensive coordination with other programs. We would annually report our permit tracking activities to the ETAC and Council, and we would hope that ETAC would provide input and guidance on what we're doing, particularly related to the technical components and data acquisition and management. The third alternative is basically implementing the proposal or draft outline that ETAC has been working on. It's an ambitious effort that responds to the identified need for local data and was developed over many months or even potentially years with the input of just dozens and dozens of experts. I actually have copies of that if you would like to see the actual draft plan that ETAC has been working on. And you can read here, they have established a number of monitoring parameters that would be included in the program. And they include eelgrass and kelp, intertidal beach sediment supply, marine riparian vegetation, water quality, and estuarine emerging vegetation or salt marsh. Again, it would use the land use land cover map to establish a baseline. And this major difference here is that it would require new staff. It would require a monitoring program coordinator. There's been a lot of discussion about among ETAC members about how much of a coordinator basically they would need. It's hard to kind of parse people apart, but it's definitely something that is above and beyond what the existing planning staff has the capabilities for. So I did a little bit of math, not my strong suit, but assuming a 50% FTE, the annual program cost for this would be, you can see the numbers, $72,000 to $87,000. One FTE raises that quite a bit, and that's not something that couldn't be funded through grant funding, as well as the other items talked about in Alternative 2. So this also envisions quite an involved volunteer and community participation element, and the same sort of extensive coordination with other agencies and efforts that I talked about in Alternative 2. And really this would start out with something like a data gap analysis, where we looked at what is being done, who's doing it, and how can Bainbridge use it as part of their program. And it would have similar oversight as Alternative 2. I think at that point I'm going to stop and see if you have any questions or if you guys would like to discuss it among yourselves.
Thank you. All right, we'll go ahead now and take questions from the council. And Steve?
It was a great presentation. I learned a lot. The one thing I don't quite understand is what kind of active monitoring is required on new development. If you have an existing structure and you modify the structure, you need a permit, mm-hmm. and you need to do mitigation. What kind of active monitoring then is done after the permit is, you get the permit, you build whatever it is, you plant whatever you plant.
Sure.
Then what's the active monitoring that occurs after that that's required?
So one of my favorite SMP phrases is site-specific, because it's very site-specific. But basically, it would depend on every project that comes in for review.
But there is active monitoring.
There is active monitoring. Okay, the SMP requires five years of monitoring.
All right. So then I have a question. Does that monitoring then go as some kind of a lien against the deed? Because if that property is sold, that monitoring still needs to occur. So how does that, what's the process that we use to collect that?
Yeah, the monitoring is, that's a good question. The mitigation area, the SMP requires a notice on title. But the monitoring, and I apologize for not having this on the top of my head, but
okay.
There are options to make sure that the monitoring is passed.
So essentially then when a project gets approved, mm-hmm. then you have to impact the title. So there's going to be a title change.
The SMP requires a notice on title.
Okay.
Yes. And that's the same for the critical areas ordinance. That requires a notice on title as well. That's not exclusive to the SMP.
But I wasn't aware that it required monitoring. I know there's a notice on title
that exists,
mm-hmm. but that's different than a notice that says that you're signing up to do monitoring for some period of time.
I'm sorry. I think that I might have been confusing for you. The notice on title is that the area of mitigation, any development in that area is precluded. It doesn't necessarily say that monitoring of that area is required.
And so, but my question is, if monitoring is required, and that becomes then attached in some fashion to the title, how does that? So we need to be able to do that.
Right. That's a good question. Okay. I will try to get an answer for you.
Okay.
Other questions, Sarah?
Well, so if someone develops or builds something on the shoreline or adds to, and they're required to monitor for a period of time?
Yes, they are.
So someone's already monitoring it?
If you have
someone other than the city.
Correct. If you have an identified impact, you are required to compensate for that and then mitigate your compensatory mitigation or monitor your compensatory mitigation. And part of the alternative to monitoring program, as well as the periodic review, would be a roll-up of all of the data collected from the individual mitigation requirements or mitigation projects that are happening due to development.
I think you're talking about two different things. You were talking about at individual homes or sites, and you're talking about the whole program.
I'm talking about on a permit-by-permit basis.
Okay, thank you.
If your development results in a need for mitigation, you're required to monitor that mitigation project. You're then required to submit to the city, and we're developing standards for this currently, but you are required to submit to the city, potentially on an annual basis, the results of your monitoring program. Because part of your permit review will be that you need to submit a mitigation plan, and part of a mitigation plan is a maintenance and monitoring plan.
Can you give me an example of what maybe a common type of monitoring would be?
Most monitoring will be for marine riparian vegetation. It would be establishing photo points, and it would be looking at things like plant survival. You go out and do plant counts. You look and see which type of species is surviving, if you've got any sort of invasive species infestation, if you've got any sort of native volunteers. You look at overall plant survival mortality as well as percent cover.
Roger?
And are you also including shellfish monitoring, or we heard a lot about that this morning, but are the mm-hmm. water quality or fish and water life?
Not.
I mean,
so
water quality is
potentially a parameter that can be included in a monitoring program.
Okay. And so I guess the question is twofold.
On a permit?
Yeah,
one is
the permit dialogue
right.
we're having now, and then also mm-hmm. How that fits into the three alternatives that are
right.
on
so,
table today.
So the monitoring, the mitigation that has to be done on a permit level is based on either use of a standard mitigation manual for single-family residential development or a site-specific analysis, which would then have a site-specific mitigation plan. So again, it's somewhat site-specific. So if the project is going to potentially impact water quality or a shellfish growing area, then the project would require mitigation of those parameters.
Wait, go ahead, Mike, and then we'll come back to you. Michael?
I just had a question about alternative three. You noted that there's a possibility of grant funding. I wonder if any investigation has been done of the availability of grants and the what the prospect for grant funding might be.
Currently, the only grant that is being investigated, I'm going to come back and talk with you about next week, and that's a national estuary program, the NEP grant. And it's the land use theme that's got three different themes in the funding pot. And it's EPA money, I think, that's allocated through the Department of Ecology. They've got three different themes, one of which is land use management. So it's to me, it seems really quite a good opportunity to ask for funding that would assist with shoreline monitoring, as well as take a more holistic, comprehensive landscape watershed approach to all of our critical areas and natural resources. So that's the only one that I've looked into right now.
All right. Now, go ahead, Roger, and then I have a couple of questions.
No, go ahead.
All right. Well, thank you. Actually, I have a list, but the one I just want to verify, the periodic review is when we do another update, right? So that's
sure.
A 7 years from now periodic review.
Right.
Okay. I think that's a helpful clarification, at least to confirm it for me. I wanted to ask about the health department water quality monitoring that we learned about tonight in much greater detail. There's a cost estimated at about $40,000 a year were that to be incorporated. As I looked back at your numbers, it looked as though you had a $40,000 range for the total cost, particularly in, I think it was option two. Was it three?
Yeah.
All right. Would you tell me is where that might fit, if you think it does fit as a water quality, if we were to go back and look where it would fit in, and let's verify what the budget is. At this point, I'm leaning to definitely the staff recommendation for alternative two. So I'm interested in the funding on that. If we were to add $40,000, if as you all review this, it makes sense to think about using and supporting on a local level the health district monitoring that's already begun.
At this point, I believe in alternative two, I said that no additional funding would be required. It would require your addition of 40,000 would be an addition of 40,000, or it'd be.
So it's all right. So it's the 8,000 for the annual or for the intern,
right.
And then it potentially would be 48,000. But we can use our regular staff for that if that's a decision and a way to go. But we do need to mentally calculate if that fits. I know you've had a chance, at least now you've heard it presented orally, but I obviously from your comments you had a chance to look at and maybe are very familiar with the health district monitoring program. Do you see it as being as complementary as it seems to me, complementary with an E, as it seems to me at this point?
Well, a couple of things. One is that they're measuring for human health,
right.
And which is a little bit different than the goal of a shoreline master program monitoring program. But that being said, what I heard tonight is that they are out in the field collecting data at a number of different points and on a much more comprehensive level, I think, than we would be able to do on our own. So I think that just even having those GPS data points, I think, would be very valuable. But other than that, they're only collecting data for one parameter, which is bacteria, which is tied back to something that really actually doesn't have a nexus with the SMP.
So, in fact, this might not be. It may be that we, as an organization, as a city, may choose to think about supporting that monitoring program, but not because it fits in with this per se. It may have some additional information that you could draw on, but they're not really as linked as they might seem on the surface. Okay.
Yes.
Surface being not the operative word there. Okay. Val, and then I do have a couple of other questions. Go ahead, please.
Well, just to follow up on that, you're going to talk to us next week about this NEP grant opportunity. And looking at just a little bit that you mentioned here in the material tonight, it sounds like at least the title of that would fit the shoreline monitoring described by the health department as well as the kind of monitoring you're proposing for the SMP. And so over the next week, perhaps you could give a little thought to whether or not there might be an opportunity to roll a grant proposal together that would cover both the operations that you envision for SMP monitoring and the shoreline monitoring that might complement what the health department's doing.
Absolutely, and the intention really, my thoughts on the NEP grant really is to kind of throw everything in that makes sense, because that's what they actually like to see. The whole idea of that grant program is taking a watershed-based approach, so that would make sense.
Good, thank you. And my only observation beyond that, and you've just already said it, but I want to underscore, one of the things I like especially about number or alternative two, and certainly it's a component of alternative three, which just seems to me to be something desirable, but not necessarily this not being the appropriate place for us to put money to develop a new program without having discussed whether that's the new program we want, and we can comply and go beyond if we were to choose alternative two. I like the fact, especially the collaboration across jurisdictions in the region, that that's very important. The water doesn't know that it doesn't flow. The shorelines, in fact, do have a contiguous underbase, and that seems quite appropriate. I also really like something that helps support and make real the efforts that are going on with a high-performance organization where you have cross-departmental work happening in a way that we see it and that it's not... I mean, I think that happens at the city, but this is a very specific program that calls that out and asks that it be done. So I'm particularly supportive of that aspect. It's the collaboration piece.
Right, and I mentioned Public Works, but I'd also like to mention the Building Division, because our permit tracking database software, I've been relying a lot on the Building Division to help me make that work for our shoreline, not only just tracking, but also to tease out what we can in terms of useful information for a monitoring program. So it's, again, another example of coordination with other departments.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. Now, yeah, Steve, and then we'll go ahead and take the public comment.
One of my biggest concerns on SMP monitoring was 7 years from now, are we going to be back to another $1 million SMP? That's not quite a million, but in round numbers, it was close to $1 million. And 2 years of time and about 30 to 40% of council meetings were spent just dealing with SMP. You know, if the Department of Ecology has said all we have to do is to follow our SMP for new development and that achieves no net loss, does that mean in 7 years, we can just stand up and say, based on the reports we've already done, we have been following the SMP, there is no net loss, and we don't have to update the SMP? You understand the question. I mean, that's my real question.
Sure, and I've heard it before. I can't imagine anything would be that simple. But what I want to emphasize really is that if we do a good job of implementing this SMP, and we intend to, I think that this tracking of it will result in the council and staff and community having more information at our hand when we come to the update process than we did the last time around.
Except the last time around, it was the science of changing buffers and changing a lot of construction and sight lines and a bunch of things that really, it doesn't sound like we're going to have any data that suggests that that is resulting in no net loss. All we're saying is that we are doing exactly what the SMP is achieving. You know, if the monitoring program on the vegetation is the vegetation is dying for whatever reason, I assume that you have to put new vegetation in. Mm-hmm. So you are going to have and achieve whatever it is that permit says, and you know, and we'll have that, and that's what we'll have in 7 years. You won't have any real data in terms of what the impact is on the you know, the no net loss of of the water functions or any of those things in anything other than those particular locations. So if that's all it takes to say that there is no net loss because that's the criteria that, that ecology is using, then why would we have to update? What new information would we have that would say that we have to change the policies?
So you have to review, and I would presume that at the end of 7 years there would be some sort of updating that you'd want to do in terms of a limited amendment. It wouldn't necessarily need to be a comprehensive update like you experienced last time. You will have new data. I mean, I think that the land use land cover map is establishing a baseline, and hopefully that will be repeated, and therefore you will be able to see some measure of change if there is change. Now, I think that it is difficult. I think this whole notion of an SMP monitoring program, because that nexus, which I think is what you're searching for, is really difficult to establish.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason why I tend to focus on the permit tracking, the mitigation requirements, the monitoring requirements on a permit review level basis is because that's what we know and that's what we can control and that's what we're actually regulating. So I think that it is hard. It's a hard question. But I'm hoping that at the end of this 7 year period, we will have sufficient information to say, have the regulations resulted in change. And it could be that there isn't a net loss, that we have achieved that. And in that case, then there isn't a need for an update, or, you know, substantial amendment to the SMP.
My question had to do with the restoration plan actions.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that that's incorporated into the SMP, that then will be part of the monitoring. Am I correct? And isn't that something that we want to know about, whether the plans and the steps that have been taken restoratively, that being a much more proactive than the number counting, which is
right.
The permit tracking.
Right. So, again, we're monitoring the SMP, the program, and part of that program okay. is the restoration plan. So you look at the idea of no net loss basically has built into it that you are going to have loss based on development. But we say that's okay because development is a preferred use. Some developments are preferred use in the shoreline. So what you have to do to compensate for that is restore above mm-hmm. and beyond. So that's the idea behind how the SMP in and of itself will achieve no net loss, because you have voluntary restoration actions as well as permit action.
And the mitigation.
So yes, part
yeah, okay.
of monitoring is tracking voluntary restoration actions and then looking at your cumulative impact analysis at again to see how they've affected your overall function.
Good. Thank you. Are there other questions right now from the council? All right. I would go to the community. And do you have questions or comments that you'd like to make to the council with regard to what you've heard? Yes. Go ahead. Oh, okay. All right, well, then we'll do it in that order. I appreciate that. We can be a little informal around here, and we don't need to be that informal, so thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for doing it that way. Thanks. And the first person on the list is Meridale Gale, followed by Elise Wright.
It doesn't appear that our light is working, so I'll give you a verbal 30 seconds.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Meridale Gale. I'm a Winslow resident, and I am also a Planning Commission member who worked for all of the years on the SMP update, so I know the amount of time and energy, expense and effort that went into this. I want to acknowledge Christy Carr and the work that she is now doing on this particular issue of monitoring, because one of the real shocks in this whole process working with the Department of Ecology was when we learned in the summer of 2014 that the at our SMP hearings that they basically don't have any solid plans or requirements for shoreline monitoring. There was an audible gasp in this room when we learned that they really didn't give a rip. What we did, it was just lip service, basically. The requirement of the Shoreline Master Program is that there be no net loss of ecosystem functioning, and that requires us to do whatever monitoring it takes to enable us to know how well our SMP is working. I sure don't want to go through what we went through the last 3.5 or 4 years. It would be really nice if we could get to a point that Steve is searching for, where it becomes a fairly simple update process. But I, for that reason, of the identified alternatives, I would really urge the Council to adopt the ETAC proposal. ETAC is appointed by the City Council. It's the Environmental Technical Advisory Committee. I know that they have been working for a number of years on this exact issue of what would constitute an effective monitoring program for our community. And to just brush that aside and say, well, if we can get by with less, let's just do that. That's a fool's way out. Our Puget Sound needs to be protected, and to find out in 7 years that we haven't done a good enough job is not okay. We need to be proactive in this and do more than the minimal requirement that the Department of Ecology has placed on us, which is basically nothing. I work with the Bainbridge Beach Naturalist. I've done a lot of volunteer work on the shoreline areas through Bainbridge Island Land Trust, through the Beach Naturalist. I worked with the City of Bainbridge Island on my hands and knees counting eelgrass strands where you put that new road thing down there on Rockaway Beach.
Ms. Gales, 30 seconds.
I know that volunteers... What was that?
I just was giving you a 30-second warning, and
okay.
I've distracted you.
I know that volunteers are really important in these efforts, and so I would encourage that we use the approach which maximizes the involvement of the volunteer community. And Steve articulated quite clearly why we should use the ETAC proposal, because that will give us the most information that we will need to go forth and make adjustments as we go rather than just coming up to the end. So thank you, and I also believe it's the Council's responsibility to determine the best approach and not just pass that back to staff. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Elise Wright, and then Lisa Macchio follows.
I'm Elise Wright. I'm here on behalf of the Bainbridge Alliance for Puget Sound, and as you know, or may know, more than half of our members are scientists, and two of them want to speak. And if it's all right with you, I prefer to have them speak before I do, because I am not a scientist.
All right, thank you. So we'll go to Lisa Macchio and David Sale.
Hi, I'm Lisa Macchio. I live at 5315 Old Mill Road. I just wanted to say, I don't know if some of you know, but I work for the Environmental Protection Agency. I'm not here speaking on their behalf, but I'm a water quality specialist. I'm not a nearshore habitat specialist. But I just want to say a few words. One, we're living with a lot of uncertainty. I think you guys are asking good questions, and I think Christy is well-versed in monitoring. But what I want to tell you that I think you may not be aware of is that this no net ecological loss concept is something nobody knows how to deal with. Ecology can't tell you how to monitor for that, neither can the Environmental Protection Agency, and neither can Christy Carr, and neither can ETAC. So we're all operating without guidance. So we live with those uncertainties, and I think you have to realize you do the best you can. So what I would say to you is think very, very carefully about what you want for the city. So here's something that comes up day after day at the Environmental Protection Agency. Somebody went out and got some data, and they want to say something about it. And the EPA looks at that and says, that's some crappy data. You really can't say very much about it. So if you're thinking about 7 years from now, you want to have some data to drive decisions about, did we do the right thing? Did we do the wrong thing? If you go out and get no data or minimal data, you are not going to be able to answer those questions that come up. And I'll tell you another thing about government agencies. Ecology may tell you today, all you have to do is implement the SMP. 7 years from now, I'm going to tell you for sure there's going to be more information. Ecology will change their guidance because EPA does all the time. And people are very uncomfortable with uncertainty. I really want to tell you that 7 years from now, ecology is not going to promise you today that what they told you to do today is going to fulfill 7 years from now. We are all living with no idea how to monitor no net ecological loss. You talk about water quality data, that's insufficient. You need to collect habitat information. You need to collect a robust set of parameters that will give you some sense. I would just tell you, I'm not an expert in this field, but you have some great people on ETEC that are thinking very carefully about what you might need. Again, nobody knows the answer. But if you spend a little bit of money, and I don't think that's a whole lot of money, and bless the ETAC approach, I think you're going to be in a very better position. And I can tell you for sure, from what I've seen in the Puget Sound program at EPA, they want to fund this stuff. They want somebody out there driving the train and saying, hey, we've got an idea here, get behind us, support us. And I just want to say, there's no guarantees for anything. So you want to deal with uncertainty, you better spend some money and collect some robust information. That's. And I'm not blessing anything. I just would like to say, think very carefully.
Thank you very much. We do need you all to help us with paying attention either to the more subtle finger wrap-up signal or the red light. Would you like to come next, please? This is David Sale and then Wayne Daly.
Thank you. My name is Dave Sale from over on Sunrise Drive, and I'm actually here as a former chair of ETAC. I wanted to kind of see where we went, and I want to really tell Christy what a great job. I mean, we handed you a monster, and you've at least shaped it somehow. I think that the approach of starting with the second alternative is a good one. I think down the road where you really want to land is a hybrid of two and three. And that may mean, you know, ETAC suggested a whole bunch of parameters, but it doesn't mean you have to do every one of them. You could do two or three of them very well and not try to spread yourself too thin. But I think another important point of this, because as Lisa pointed about uncertainties here, and really we're kind of inventing this process as we go, and there will be support, funding support and coming from other people. But I think it's really going to be critical to do an annual review and have that sort of institutionalized. So it doesn't have to be painful. It just means that at the end of each, at the end of each year, maybe it's in the fall, at the end of the sampling season, but you sort of write up and talk about, put up a summary of what's been done, bring it to ETAC, sit down and talk about it, bring it to council and say, look, this is what we've done so far. And then you can suggest that, okay, look, if this is the point we're trying to get to, we really need to make a course adjustment here. We need to maybe add this parameter, be a little bit more aggressive on some of our monitoring here. But I think the general approach that Christy's come up with is a good one. And I think starting carefully is pretty good. We didn't put out the gold standard for monitoring, but admittedly what we put out was pretty ambitious. So I think starting like this the first year, getting your feet underneath you for both the staff and the city, and getting the volunteers, getting the community involved, which I think is going to be a real critical piece. King County started to do a process like this quite a few years ago when they did their last CAO update. And they didn't get to do what they wanted to do initially, but they did get a program going. And by involving people in it, you develop a better understanding.
And you start, you don't take that wide gap of perspective and close it entirely, but you might be able to bring it down and narrow it a little bit. So I think it's a great start, and I'm glad you guys are moving forward with it. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. And next is Wayne Daly, and then we'll go back to Elise. Thank you. Well, we've got Robert is then after you.
My name is Wayne Daly. I live at 1646 Jeanette Place, Winslow. I would just like to commend the city staff for what they've done. Their plans have been well prepared, and I really have a great deal of respect for Christy also in what's been prepared. But I also have a great deal of respect for ETAC. I was involved in providing some input in the process of determining what is appropriate for a monitoring plan in the early stages. They've done a great job in putting a lot of work, and as Mardell indicated, they are professionals. They know what they're talking about. They've worked hard at what they've done. I think the issue before us in terms of monitoring and no-let loss, I think we already have an example of the terrible situation we're in. If you're not aware, there was an article in the Kitsap Sun, I think at the end of the week last week, concerning the state of our 4-H fish population, and particularly the herring and smelt in Puget Sound. It's such dire conditions that the state has put together a budget plan of $2 million to try and assess what the hell is happening to our 4-H fish, and it's because we've destroyed the shoreline habitat. 4-H fish start in the shoreline, in the nearshore habitat. And if we don't take care of that nearshore habitat and take care of this critical element of salmon, which is 4-H fish, salmon have to have 4-H fish to survive, and orca have to have salmon to survive. So the monitoring aspect of what we're doing is a key element. And the comment that we can't define no net loss is probably a very accurate statement. How in the hell do you find no net loss when you don't know where you started from? And so to have a basic point to start from, which is what I think ETAC has provided us, and certainly the concept of making a melded plan is not totally out of the question, but there is no question that we have to have a viable monitoring plan if we really want to save and protect what we have in Puget Sound, because it's already gone downhill so dramatically that we have a hell of a lot of work to do to get back somewhere towards the beginning. As I've said in a previous hearing, when I first came to the Puget Sound area in 1961, working for Boeing as an engineer, the salmon derby in the summer, there were 30,000 people fishing for salmon in Elliott Bay alone. Now Elliott Bay is closed to fishing, and we have a very limited season, and you cannot kill a wild fish. So think very carefully about what you do with your plan. Thank you.
Thank you. And I would invite, let me just go back to Elise, if I may, Robert, and then it'll be, and you're to follow her.
See, I knew that would be a smart move on my part.
Thank you.
So I'm Elise Wright. I'm not here, I guess I'm just here as a representative from Bainbridge Alliance. And my comments are informed by another of our members, Marcy Lagerlof, who's a scientist, who can't be here tonight, but has either or will send her comments to you directly. Her feeling is that option three, which was the one proposed by ETAC, is the only one that actually measures ecological function. And I'd just like to remind us that the reason for the SMP is not to monitor what we're doing on the shore, but to monitor what's happening in the water. And from 2002 to 2011, the Bainbridge Island Land Trust, the Suquamish Tribe, the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and our city did beach seining. And they found that there were juvenile salmon and herring and smelt, all the 4-H fish, on every place that they seined all around the island every month of the year. I would hope that that's here still, but it sounds like it isn't. What we need, I think, is a full assessment to measure what is here, and I believe that option three goes more towards obtaining that assessment and then doing rigorous monitoring and checking on permitting. I know that budget constraints are an issue, and Councilwoman Blossom has mentioned many times that that the council needs to establish their priorities before making decisions. I would urge you to begin with option two and move into option three, or at least at some point consider that that the surrounding environment, the health of the waters, are of primary importance to all of us who live here, as well as to people in the rest of the Sound, and to move towards a more rigorous monitoring and enforcement process. Marcy's last thought was about adaptive management, rather than the which answers, I hope, Councilman Bonkowski's concerns about, you know, what happens in 7 years. With an adaptive management approach, we could review the monitoring information at least a couple of times within that 7 years, good, and find out if we're doing a good job of protection, and or is there new information that suggests we need to monitor anything we've missed. We hope there'll be an opportunity to comment later when one of these options is fleshed out. And I thank you for your time. And Ms. Carr, she is, I thought we'd never get over losing Ryan Erickson, but Christy is really good.
Thank you. Robert?
My name is Robert Deschel. I live at 6370 Northeast Tolo. I'm going to take a little different approach here, and I'm going to encourage the council to go with a fiscally conservative approach. No net loss, we're looking at the SMP no net loss. What does our regulation, what does that contribute to a loss or not a loss in Puget Sound? It's not whether Puget Sound is dying, because it has all kinds of problems. No net loss is a general concept, but it's not scientifically measurable. If it were measurable, ecology would have you measuring it. Puget Sound Partnership has a science committee, and it meets, it's been meeting since 2007. The mayor is aware of this. She goes to the meetings, I believe. In December 2014, the 2015 and 16 biennial plan was approved. But one of the most revealing discussions ever on Puget Sound science came with that document. $54 million has been spent on science studies in Puget Sound, 182 separate studies being conducted, about $7 million a year. And the lead scientist for Puget Sound Partnership said, the bottom line, by 2020, when the $20 billion Puget Sound cleanup was supposed to be completed, no way is the science going to be completed. The ecological functions of Puget Sound are way too complex to understand in as short a period of time as 13 years. And when you've got science, hundreds of scientists working on Puget Sound Partnership science, what are the chances that we're going to be able to take one or two people or volunteers and be able to prove no net loss? We have lost sea stars. That's a virus problem. We have eelgrass. We have invasive eelgrass. Eelgrass beds are changing all the time. We have storms. We have ocean acidification. We have temperature changes. We have little snowpack, for example, that comes into Puget Sound this year because we don't have any snow. How are you going to make, if you observe a change, how are you going to relate that to the SMP? The answer is you are not. And if you fund it, this is going to be general funds. I'm not opposed to any grant funding you can get. That's great. But you're going to be spending general funds. We've got to build a police station. We've got to build parks. We've got docks. We've got roads. And that's what's competing with this. And the answer is, I don't think you're going to get anywhere.
Thank you. Appreciate the wrap-up. Does anyone else who's not had a chance to sign up wish to speak? Okay, thank you. And I have one comment, and then I really am going to let the rest of the council speak. But I think there's been a lot of attention, appropriately, to the work that ETAC has done during the process of the development of our SMP update and in helping to design and think about all of the work about what monitoring might look like and then helping to make some proposals. The reality is we almost don't have an ETAC committee going forward. So my plea is for all of you who are listening, watching, thinking about it, and the council members to think of ways to support the two existing members on ETAC. We need the scientists. Oh, I'm getting a third one that I don't... I was going to say, okie doke. So we, at this point, I was aware of two, but I'm getting the word from the previous chair that there are three. We need, for sure, additional scientists to be on this committee and help provide that guidance. That's a key and crucial perspective that has to be there no matter what option we take. So this is my very public plea, and we need to go on a recruiting binge and find the people to help us. They do exist on Bainbridge Island. We have a wealth of people with this concern and the backgrounds that are appropriate. So that's that. You want to say something? I'll let you please do, and then we'll go ahead if there are other questions from up here. Did you just come to be responsive? Okie doke. That's great. Then you don't have to make any more speeches till we call on you specifically. Thank you. Are there other questions or comments from the council, and including advice about our next step? Sarah? All right. You guys, it's those eyebrows. I don't read them.
I just can't resist.
Okay.
The opportunity to thank Meridell Gale for calling us fools. But in fact, we would really be foolish if we didn't recognize the quality of work that the staff had done on this.
Yeah.
And think very seriously about the recommendations of the staff.
Okay, thank you. Sarah?
So I'm just thinking, I know they're related, but I'm kind of thinking of them in two different pieces. There's what we're required to do and what people would like to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me, from what I heard, that there's this no net loss requirement, and we're requiring new development on the shoreline to do some sort of monitoring already. I mean, that, and so would one of these alternatives be involve reviewing that monitoring that the private homeowner's doing?
Yes.
Okay.
Do only one of them or all three?
Definitely alternative two and three. Alternative two is really focused on kind of manipulating our permit tracking database
right. To
be shoreline specific, to specifically monitor the monitoring. And it's something that we're working on right now. Staff is working on a set of standard conditions, not only standard mitigation requirements, but also standard conditions for permit approvals, so that we have some sort of metrics that we can move forward and then roll up at the end of a year or at the end of 7 years, so that we will have data that is generated from that monitoring that is required to occur.
Okay. So how I'm kind of along the lines of what Robert had mentioned, that I would support alternative two to satisfy what we're required to do.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's some kind of alternative funding that we can get through a grant or some other means, then we could do more. And I would support doing more. But for now, I think I'd like to stick with alternative two.
Okay, thank you. Michael?
My question is, a couple of the speakers advocated starting with alternative two and then considering implementation of additional measures from the alternative three plan. Has staff considered whether there should be periodic review and recommendation for changes or perhaps increase in monitoring?
That would be included in a monitoring program, yes. And I should clarify, actually, that the ETAC proposal has a year one work plan that kind of gears itself up, recognizing that it's a pretty heavy lift in terms of funding and staffing. So for that first year, it wouldn't be a crazy data collection exercise. So it is built in somewhat into the alternative three and would be as well in alternative two.
Yeah.
Are there other questions? I have one about the adaptive management approach and the fact that that wasn't specifically called out, but it sounds, I mean, that comment leads me to believe that that is anticipated and would be an appropriate thing. Does it, are you thinking that way?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was sort of what I was trying to accomplish with that graphic illustration.
Okay.
And amazingly, I couldn't get the arrows to work in Word to show adaptive management.
They don't know. Well, they need some adaptation.
Yeah. But, yeah, that feedback loop, and as Dave mentioned, an annual reporting process would be really helpful with that, and in order to be able to, if changes need to be made, then they can be made.
Okay. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other comments? Can I just get a sense, I mean, I'm hearing from at least three of us that are leaning toward the support and asking the staff to develop the alternative number two, and I would really like to have the adaptive management piece, you know, explicitly called out in there, but that is my read of it. But I'd like to hear from other people as direction to staff. Val?
Well, just to get the ball rolling, I move that the City Council authorize staff to finalize option two of the SMP monitoring program alternatives.
Okay, thank you. I beg your pardon?
Second.
Okay, and I've moved and seconded. Is there any further conversation or questions? Roger?
Well, my comment would be that I certainly think that investing in more data is going to be helpful. I mean, I think it sounds like there's no guarantee around that. And so I'll support the motion with an eye towards additional programs as they become more apparent and things that are going to be helpful. So I'll be supporting the motion.
Okay, thank you. Steve?
I'm in the same boat as Roger, a little bit more strongly believe that alternative three is where we need to go. In the development of our existing SMP, there was no data that came from Bainbridge Island, no hard data in terms of ecological function. We had no history. We did the survey around the island. But the buffers and those issues were established by looking at other ecological data that was taken in other locales. As you indicate on the your alternative three implements a monitoring plan proposed by the ETEC committee. And includes ecological, and it's the only alternative that includes ecological monitoring parameters on Bainbridge Island. And my sense is without that, you know, when we look to the future and say, where have we been and where are we going and what have we done, we'll be able to tell for a very, very small percentage of the island, because of what's occurred, because it's only impacts those that it's new development. And Kathy, was it at 95% of the island is already developed in terms of the parameter?
It's over
90%. So new development is any kind of a modification that impacts or whatever, or any kind of new construction on the shoreline. With the shoreline already built out, a majority of the shoreline is not going to be changed in the next 7 years. So this is the only option, I think, that gives you an ability to look at the rest of the island and what its function ecologically looks like during that period. And I think that's going to be important when we look at overall as an island, you know, where we want to be and what our impact is on the environment. So
I agree, but I have a question about that. It appears to me, as at least as I'm reading alternative number two, it does in fact call out looking at things other than just the permitting. I mean, it is, well, I don't know, am I mistaken?
Yeah, I recognize, Steve, that that might be somewhat confusing.
Bullet number two.
So the ETAC proposal has actual ecological parameters spelled out in it. They've spent an incredible amount of time and got input from a number of people to determine what those parameters should be. So that's the difference between the two alternatives in terms of the only one that calls out the ecological parameters. Alternative two would collect data on yet to be identified ecological parameters using the existing data plots that we get from the land use land cover map.
From that LIDAR and develop.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Because I would absolutely agree
with Steve,
I'm just reading this and thinking, I think it addresses your concern.
But it only does that once. You get the baseline now.
You get the baseline right once.
Right.
And then
on two.
And then alternative two would collect data, more limited data, not as much as alternative three, because we can't really anticipate with no new funding or not a monitoring coordinator to have people, whomever they would be, doing the type of monitoring the type of parameters that are spelled out in alternative three.
Okay.
Thank you. It looked as though Val, but let me ask Wayne. He's not had a chance, and then we'll come back to you. Thank you.
I support the motion, and mostly I just want to say let's go. Let's get on with this. I have to think that this or some future council is going to see the results of this work and have this discussion again about how good it is and how we want to move forward. You know, we can only anticipate where we're going to go. I like option two, how it's going to get us off. Get started, and let's adapt and meld and do those things we need to do to get it done.
Okie doke. Thank you, Val.
Just for information, when you get this map and you pick your ground truthing, 50 ground truthing spots, what are the criteria that you use for identifying?
Well, that's a good question, actually, because the currently the way that the scope of work is written for that project is that they're random in order to ground truth the map. So my intention is to work with the mapper and to establish those points where we will be able to collect data that makes sense for monitoring. So that's sort of a tweak on the grant program work is instead of, if you're going to collect 50 random points, well, can we have 10 or 20 or 30 of those where we can establish criteria to say, here are locations where we know we can collect data that will be important for our monitoring efforts.
Yeah, I'd like to have some justification for those being random as opposed to being consciously thought out so that they fit into the overall program.
Right. Well, the random, I think, is the methodology of the land use land cover map creation. I'm not familiar enough with that methodology or that process, but that's an opportunity that we have this grant funding to do that and to establish those points and to collect data at those points. And so my intention is to work with them to make sure that we do have some intention as to establishing where those are located.
Thanks.
Thank you. Michael?
Just a point of clarification on alternative two. It states that there's no new funding required until the periodic update in 7 years. And but we are also looking at exploring a grant program. If we were successful in a grant application, would the new funds be used to enhance alternative two, to go beyond it?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That would be the intention.
Thank you. Do you have other questions, or are we in a position now to vote on the motion, which is to deal with number two, to recommend that the staff please go forward and develop fully for council formal action based on alternative number two? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Thank
opposed.
You. Oh, I beg your pardon. All right. The motion passes 6-1. Stephen Bonkowski voting no. Thank you. Next on the agenda are the committee reports. We don't have any included in the packet, and I don't know if anyone would like to make an oral report on a committee. It's usually it seems to me it's the first and second weeks of the month that are the hummers, and so you can anticipate committee reports in weeks 3 and 4. Thank you. All right. On the upcoming council agendas, and I would turn this part of it, we have a copy of the proposed agenda for, or draft agenda for next week was distributed. It's on the dais to look at for March 3rd, and we'll go to city manager, Doug.
Okay, so staff intensive items, we have the community services funding framework presentation. We have public safety site selection discussion. That's an information item. Transfer of the Kitsap County tidelands to Bainbridge Island, to the city of Bainbridge Island. This is something that's, it's in a lot of ways, it's a housekeeping issue that should have been taken care of when the island became a
city.
City government. So, long time coming with that.
I have a question on that. So, as of if they're Kitsap County tidelands right now, so the it's the Kitsap County tidelands that is responsible. The SMP for Kitsap County, not ours, for those tidelands?
No, because they own it. It's not their jurisdiction.
That's a SMP is a jurisdictional question, not ownership.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
Okay, and then item D is John Nelson Park at Strawberry Cannery Cove stream restoration, stormwater project improvements. We've had a briefing on that. Item E, the contract amendment for Rodolphe project monitoring for Pritchard Park East and Strawberry Plant Park. That's actually John Nelson Park at Strawberry Cannery Cove.
And maybe when we get to that, it might be helpful for everybody in the community as well as council members and so forth to talk about just something that's a little bit more descriptive of the project monitoring. I mean, there's a reason for doing that monitoring.
Yes.
And now I'm just thinking is that it might just be helpful to have a little more information about the name of the project, I mean, of the monitoring, the reason or whatever. Thank you.
Okay, item F, Christy Carr talked about this earlier in her presentation, the National Estuary Program Watershed Protection and Restoration Grant Opportunity. And we have three public works contracts, the interlocal agreement with Port Gamble Tribe for the police motorcycles, the Linwood Center Outfall Improvement Project, and the Groundwater Assessment Professional Services Agreement. And then item H is the Memorandum of Understanding with the U.S. Marshals Service for the Violent Offender Task Force. And then a council discussion item. This is one that came up during the council advance where there was discussion, at least a desire expressed to have a discussion about the transfer of Pritchard Park to Bainbridge Island Metropolitan Parks District. So those are the items for next meeting.
Could I just halt right here for a second before we go on to the others and talk about the discussion goal for the council discussion about the transfer of Pritchard. It seems to me that the direction we would want would be to give direction to staff in some way. And should we vote or want to go in that direction, they might come back with an agenda bill that lays this out, whatever our direction is. And if we choose not to go forward, we've also, I think, need to provide direction to staff to say, take a deep breath on this one. So my hope is that the discussion goal is direction to the staff about next steps. Is that an agreeable expectation? Okay, thanks. Okay. Can we go on? Yes.
All right, then the March 10th meeting, proclamation regarding the Traumatic Brain Injury Awareness Day. The license agreement.
I think it's actually the month, but that's okay. March is that month.
That's right. Then the license agreement with Madison Diner for trail access, Linwood Center outfall groundwater assessment, the interlocal agreement, the memorandum of understanding. Well, all the rest of those items are consent agenda that would move forward from the 3rd. And then the work session item we've got planned for the March 10th meeting is the traffic impact fees discussion and ordinance.
Good. Thanks.
So somewhere in here, I think that we're, Lisa may have a different view, but I think we're going to be ready to bring the leash deal back to the council. Do you want to hear that on a study session, or do you want, we had a proposed ordinance before. What we're bringing back is a revised proposal, so I don't know how you want to deal with it.
Right, and the revision was actually something proposed by a member of the community based on the discussion we had earlier, and so I've taken that revision request back to the attorney for the property owner, and I haven't heard back yet. So if we don't hear back from...
I'm talking about the leash law.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said lease, Madison. Madison.
That's
lease.
My cold speaking.
Oh, okay. The leash, I did receive your email, Councilmember Tollefson, and we can put that on an upcoming agenda whenever it's appropriate, and the city manager finds some time.
Okay. The question is, do you want to have public comment or not again?
Well, I would just suggest that I don't think something that has generated this much public interest we can avoid. I mean, I don't mean avoid, but I mean, I think we shouldn't preclude that given a newly drafted ordinance.
So that needs to be on a study session again, then.
That's fine.
That was the question.
Yeah.
Okay. I beg your pardon. Thank you.
Yeah.
So there isn't any emergency, but I'd suggest maybe March 17th.
Yeah, it looks as though it might fit there, and we can thank you.
Okay, we'll plug that in for study session on the 17th, and then we'll have a placeholder for that on the 24th for potential action.
And there's a question mark about whether or not I will be absent on the 24th, and I will. So I'm not going to be here, and I seriously doubt I'm going to try to participate long distance. So... And that'll be your meeting, sir.
Well, as a result of the discussion on the previous week, you can let us know whether or not we're permitted to vote on the leash law in your absence.
You are. Yeah. I can tell you now. I mean, it matters to me, but I absolutely have implicit trust in all of you to work it out.
I got another email, I think we all did, from Chris Hammer regarding the Tiger Grant, I believe, and we really should get kind of an update on where we think that might be.
Okay, thank you.
Because that was the one that you brought up that said...
Yes, but I haven't seen anything recently from Chris. Later today.
I didn't get one.
I didn't either.
Val did. Reminder, we have an opportunity to develop suggested projects for WSDOT and the island-wide transportation update currently underway.
This is not Tiger Grant.
That's not the Tiger Grant? Okay.
Thank you.
Are these projects that we will have to invest in? If they are, then we ought to have
I think we don't know enough yet to answer your questions.
That's the reason I'm bringing it up.
And he's badly taking notes. So maybe what we can do is, once Doug has had an opportunity to look at that and it seems appropriate to respond to the full council, we'll all learn, and it'll become a public document, could be posted. So we'll learn the answer when we do. Thank you.
I have a...
Yes, Wayne.
Somewhere in here was to be a transportation benefit district meeting.
Right, and I think it is, I thought it was March 3rd. No, excuse me, Sarah, you're our chair.
Ellen was going to be absent when it was the day it was originally scheduled.
For March 10th, so it needs to be rescheduled.
All right.
And we also will be scheduling ward meetings, so just know that that's something that we're aware of, and we won't lose them, and also we'll figure out the transportation benefit district. Thank you. Anything else? Okay, let's go on then and talk about any comments for the good of the order. You do have a draft letter, which we'll get to, but I'd like to get everyone else's comments first. Wayne?
I'll try to be brief, but I participated on George Washington's birthday, Sunday, with this first update of the Washington State time capsule, and I'm astounded by how few people even know the history of the state time capsule. It was put in place on the centennial. November 11th, 1889 is the state's founding. November 11th, 1989, a young man by the name of Canute Berger Skip had this idea that why don't we do something different? Mr. Berger has a sister, a well-known sister on the island who's an artist. And so instead of just sealing a capsule somewhere, this is a capsule that will be open in 400 years. Every 25 years, an addition will be made to it. Mm-hmm. And this is the first 25-year addition. So November 11, 2014 was the first 25 years, and then the following birthday. So this is the first time it's been opened. And the exciting thing about this is, the thing I really like, is that each round, a group of 10-year-olds from across the state is selected, and they are anointed the timekeepers for the next round. So these 35-year-olds will be back in the year 2039 and to be the new timekeepers and have their perspective on what people want to see in the year 2389. So it's a great idea. It's right at the front of the state capitol in what used to be the entrance to the capitol. It's a wonderful, but I had a chance to see it open and watch them get excited about it. The new 10-year-olds were there being sworn in. The class of 89 was retreating. So if you or your anybody you know might have a child born in 2029, they'll be eligible for the class of 2039. Might be thinking about that and get them nominated. I was very taken by it. We had a grand affair with the Secretary of State, and among the things you might ask, what do you put in a small vault that can last and be of interest to 400 years? And of course, if you think back 25, we didn't have iPhones, we didn't have any of that. So there's a lot of interest in social media and digital things. But 400 years from now, we have to be able to operate them, and they have to be able to be usable. It's one thing to put in papers and coins, but it's something else. So a wonderful amount of time was put together to build these little devices about this big with gigabytes of storage and instructions on the voltage requirements and how to hook it up and how to make it go, how to make this little thing play 400 years from now, should that be needed. I'm also pleased to say that 20-some years of KOW interviews and archives were among those things put in. And then a Kindle reader loaded with a lot of stories, and writings, things going on from people we know, some in the island, some elsewhere. So it was great. But watching these kids get excited, it makes so much sense to think about it, that each generation has their own view about the future. So I've taken a little too much time. If you're here 25 years from now, go to the, I probably won't be, go down to the state capitol for this event. It's very, very interesting.
Oh, thank you.
By the way, we're the only state, this is an original idea, we're the only state in the union that has done this.
Huh.
So.
It is exciting. Fun to hear about. Thank
how
you.
How many of the 10-year-olds that are now 35-year-olds were there? What percentage?
There were 5 of them. So not bad. And there were about 25 that were being sworn in. Now, some of them, you know, they're in Timbuktu. You know,
sure.
You're 35 years old now and you can't necessarily get back.
So it was 25 years ago.
Yes.
All right.
There were 10-year-olds.
And 5 are still around and in the area.
But they were there on Sunday. But
yeah.
There are probably more. Yeah.
It's an interesting. Thank you.
It is.
Fun to know about it.
The state should be proud.
Oh, thank you. And I have something. Does anyone else? I wanted something that we as an island can be proud of, that Maggie Hoberg, who is a senior at Bainbridge High School, has been recognized as a presidential scholar. And she also serves on the Mayor's Youth Advisory Council. So it's fun in that way, but it's really quite an honor for Maggie and a recognition of her fine intellect and hard work. So I wanted to be sure she was recognized. Then the other piece is a letter which is draft number one, and it's number one because I'm really open to somebody monkeying with it if there's a problem with it in one way or another. I'd like you to read it. It is an endorsement by this council for the Bainbridge Artisan Resource Network. They're going out for funding, and this would be a letter that would be included in as a letter of support from the city where the barn is to be constructed. There currently, you know, is the barn in the at Rolling Bay, the Rolling Barn, but this is for the new building.
Looks good to me.
Okay. Can I put unanimous? That's why it's in brackets. I'm seeing a nod from everybody, if you're all comfortable with that. Okay, that's great. Thank you very much. Is there anything else good of the order? Seeing nothing, the meeting is adjourned.